Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Thank you very much, Mr. Hario, for celebrating Memorial Day with us. I never get through that ceremony being able to sing most of the hymns. I cry most of them. Oh dear, I wish we wouldn't do that to each other. I could do a Dharma talk on that. We didn't decide exactly what day we were each going to do our talk, so I have a different topic for you, but it may not be 100% unrelated. What I want to talk about is harmony in the Sangha. And not that we in the Sangha are generally at physical war with each other, although on a few aberrant occasions in Buddhist history that has happened. Nonetheless, perhaps there are things we can all learn from the value of harmony within our own Sangha for this wider situation that we remember today. Harmony in the Sangha is, for reasons which probably have to do with my own karma, something that has always been rather dear to my heart. And it's perhaps grown more so, given my current position. Now, hopefully, through my own training and observing others and a bit of reading, I've learned a thing or two. And it's something which we monastics talk with each other about from time to time. So I simply thought I would like to offer a thing or two for you on the same topic, since you are Sangha as well. And harmony in the Sangha pertains to the entire Sangha, both the great... seems to me that first thing to think about for me is why is this important? And it seems to me that harmony in the Sangha is important for the Sangha, for each of us, and for others. Now, for the Sangha, harmony is important because a harmonious Sangha deeply fosters and flourishes, deeply fosters the flourishing of training. It is nourishing to training and practice and the finding of truth. And these are, of course, the important things. And a disharmonious Sangha inhibits those things, albeit only temporarily. Only temporarily. Because a disharmonious Sangha itself is only temporary, and the great wheel of the law rolls onward. So nothing actually can inhibit it except temporarily. But temporarily, a disharmonious Sangha does inhibit those things, and it fosters doubts, and it simply makes that which is to be done a harder thing to do, and therefore is something none of us want. Also for the Sangha, a harmonious Sangha is a treasure. The Sangha itself is a treasure, and as Dogen put it in his talk on the Kyoju Kaimon, on the precepts, when speaking of the Sangha treasure, he said, harmony is called the Sangha treasure. So within the treasure of the Sangha, its greatest treasure is harmony. And this is something that I remind myself of every day, and for that reason have put on the back of this lovely raksu which Edie sewed for me, so as to remind myself of that on a daily basis each time I put it on. Oh, sorry. It says, harmony is called the Sangha treasure. This is Dogen's quote. And of course, a disharmonious sangha is painful to behold and painful to be part of. For each of us individually, to act in ways which promote and are in accord with harmony in the sangha is a source of profound merit. And conversely, of course, to act in ways which, even inadvertently, produce disharmony in the sangha is a source of deep regret later. It produces heavy karma. And this has been widely recognized throughout the ages in Buddhism, that usually being people, we talk more about the negative side of really don't do that. Don't create disharmony in the sangha. You'll really, really regret it. But the positive side is just as much there also. It is truly the merit of acting in accord with harmony in the sangha is truly unfathomable and will have its effects. And then there are others to think of. We are all being watched. You represent the flowering of the household sangha. No one else can do that, only you. This, as I said at the beginning, is the great branch, one of the two great branches of the sangha, recognized by Shakyamuni and ever since. No monk can represent the epitome, the flowering, the best of the household sangha. Only you can do it. And you are being watched, whether you like it or not. And you are being learned from, whether you will or not. And it's important. You are acting as teachers in this and many other respects without explicitly teaching. The only question is, what are you teaching? And so, whether you teach harmony or disharmony at any given moment will have effects not just on yourself and on the sangha considered as a whole, but it will have effects on other particular people. And that is something which gives great joy or great sorrow, depending on what one finds later on in retrospect one has been teaching. So for those reasons, it seems to me that harmony in the sangha is important. And I will offer a few tips. One of the things that I found most helpful to me was Reverend Master Jiyu's rather innocuous little comment, "Each man his karma makes." Each of us, and only each of us, makes our karma and no one else's. Now, that can have a corollary, which is one does one's own training. It's rather dumb in one sense. Of course, who else's training can you do? And one can gloss over that and make it into a formula. Oh, well, it doesn't matter. I don't care. I'm going to do my own training, keep my head down and, you know, my mouth shut. That's not what it meant. It's a lot more profound than that, and a lot more compassionate than that. The first aspect that I see in each person makes their own karma is that we really do. There are karmic consequences for our acts It's something that I, at least, sometimes sort of doodle around and forget about. But forgetting about it doesn't change the fact. It simply hides the fact that every volitional action has karmic consequences. It's simply the way the universe works. And no one can measure them. One of the interesting things that the Buddha said about karma, and he said many interesting things about it, one of them is that no one can measure another's karma. It is such a vast and complex and subtle thing. Don't even try, he said. So when we look and are tempted to look at others' karma instead of our own, it may help to remember you really haven't a clue as to what karma persons X or Y are making for themselves. It's hard enough to see the karma you're making for yourself. And because each of us, and only each of us, can make our own karma, and none of us can measure another's, that helps when the temptation to try to get in there and change another person's behavior in terms of getting them to stop making their karma occurs. When I'm speaking here of effectively little acts of force that we do to each other, because these are one of the main sources of disharmony in the Sangha. With a good heart, we try to force others to do something different. And as I will go into a little bit later, there are several problems with that. Not the least of which is that it doesn't work. And the second problem is that it simply adds to your own karma. Now, why do we get into that sort of forcing thing to begin with? Let's look, take this down another level. Well, for me, one of the reasons I tend to get into that is because of my own expectations. In particular, as many of you know, I am a reforming idealist. And, you know, I have such lovely expectations. Why don't you measure up? You see how fast it comes? Why doesn't the world behave itself? Oh dear. Well, as Koho Zenji told Reverend Master, and as we've said, that's told the story many times, Jiyu-san, don't expect too much. By the way, later on, don't expect anything. Yeah, it's these expectations that, at least for me, are part of the problem. What do we have without them? If we drop, or to the extent that we drop them, what have we got? Well, we've got just what is. And that's quite enough. In response to simply what is, it is still possible to act. Dropping expectations doesn't turn you into a completely passive creature. It allows you to be active, but to be active in the sense of making offerings. To take each situation as simply, right, this is the context of my training at the moment. In this context, what can I offer? And then give the highest and purest offering of which you are capable at that moment. This completely undermines the tendency to look at the other fellow's training. The other fellow's training is simply, to you, context. They make their own karma. It is not for me to judge it, to measure it, to get in there and try to force it to come to my expectations or ideals. It is simply context. And within that context, I will do the best I can. And part of that best is compassion. So of course there will be that which wishes to be of help. But that wish to be of help, coming from that perspective, is far less likely to get in there and try to subtly force things. Because number one, that's not very helpful. Fair enough. But what if what they're doing is affecting me? Well, of course it's affecting you on one level. And on another level, again, it's simply context. It cannot prevent you, what the other fellow's doing, cannot prevent you from doing your best training. You will just be making a different offering depending on the context. What if he or she is hurting me? Well, look carefully. One of the things that helps me there is to distinguish between harm and hurt. Lots of things hurt. Generally, they hurt myself. I don't like it. Then I ask myself, well, if I were the Buddha, if I were Kanzeon, if I were Samantabhadra, whatever, and of course, how do I know what it's like to be that? But to the best of my ability, in my quiet moments, let's say, does this really affect me? Do I really hurt in my quiet moments? Well, no. Okay, Daisui, so what's hurting? Well, I don't want it to be that way. I don't think they have a very good opinion of me, and I want them to, etc., etc. Okay, there's usually a little personal hook in there that I can drop. And if it is a situation in which actual harm is being done, physical, mental, if given me and given this situation and given the state of my training at the moment, which is imperfect, I am finding this situation to be one in which I seem not to train well here and don't know what to do, then I try to quietly withdraw from that situation for a while. Not give up on it, but withdraw from it for a while, lest I myself do harm or allow harm to continue to me. That is a very different perspective from the sort of natural instinct that I have, which is essentially, stop it! And I want you to be better. Well, another question arises then, or at least it does to me, or has to me in the past, many a time. Well, if person X is wrong, it's a problem right there. Person X is wrong. They're acting selfishly, they're deluded, whatever. They don't know as much as I do. Why should I respect them? Because respect is a part of harmony in the Sangha. Why should I respect them? Well, for one thing, if I respect them, I don't close down, and I might actually learn something. And I have to grudgingly admit there is always that vague possibility that I might be mistaken. It could be that I'm the deluded one, not them. I'm not saying it is, but it could be. I don't want to close that off. And respect in the face of disagreement does not close that off. It doesn't close off anything. In fact, it opens things. And if I indulge in disrespect, even internal, the main thing that happens is that judgmental thinking goes on, and I am this man his karma makes. Now, does that mean that I am supposed to be, we are supposed to be, just passive little creatures that go along with everything? Automata, if you will. Yes, people, if you will. No, it doesn't. Does it mean that you're supposed to, we are supposed to, I am supposed to deny my own perceptions of reality? No, it doesn't. I might be wrong. I might be right. It might not matter. But what I perceive at the moment is all I've got. I can try to winnow out the attachments of self as much as I can, and what's left is what I've got to work with. And so I've got to work with it. I really don't have any choice but to act honestly and honorably upon the perceptions that I truly have. Indeed, to be a completely passive or completely automatic or completely yes person under those circumstances is less than the best I have to offer. And it's quite obviously less than the best. And one's offerings need to be the best of which one is capable. What if, in those circumstances, then, what I perceive is that my brother or sister in the Sangha, household or monastic, is doing a thing which is not to be done? Well, I cannot measure their karma. But if, in the best of my perception, it is a thing not to do, then I must not do that. I must not copy that. Because, for me, to the best of my honorable knowledge at this time, it is a thing not to be done. Therefore, I must not do it. Note that I do not require of myself, under those circumstances, to decide whether the other person is right or wrong. It's irrelevant. In some universal sense, I can't even know that. All I can know is that, for me, at this time, to my honest best perception, it is a thing I cannot do. Fair enough. So I don't have to decide right or wrong. I don't have to decide if it's a mistake or not. I don't have to decide if it's deluded or not. Just, it is something that as I am, at this moment, I cannot do. And so, I do not do it. Now, with this sort of perspective, one can approach many things with a bit less in the way of expectation and a bit less of one of my favorite senses, which is the need to fix things. Again, part of my own karmic inheritance, my own karmic past, I really, really want to get in there and make everything safe for everybody and everything right for everybody. I can't do that. It is not within my power. And even heaven help you all if it was. I'm not sure the world according to Daishui would be anything any of us would really want to live in. I mean, sounds good inside my own head, but so, in a sense, then, it's not our responsibility to fix it. And this applies in little things and in big things in the Sangha. If it's not your turn to make tea at the meditation group, you don't have to fix it if the other person is not making tea the way you think it should be made. It's their call. Let them make the tea. It doesn't require fixing. And it goes all the way up through fixing the decisions that your committee has just made that you don't necessarily agree with, fixing how the temple is run, fixing how the order is governed. We'll go back to all that in a minute, but seen in this perspective, it isn't my responsibility, even me as head of the order, it isn't my responsibility to fix these things. It's my responsibility to make the highest and best offering I can in this situation, whatever the situation may be, to take that as an offering, as we did yesterday, and place it on the altar, sense it, metaphorically speaking, metaphorically place it upon the altar, bow, and walk on with empty hands, with open hands. The funny thing is that when one stops trying to fix things, it seems to be the time when people approach you for advice, for your wise discernment on what to do about things. I had someone half kiddingly, half musingly mention to me when a year and a half ago I invited you all to send representatives to the conclave, which is, you know, the supreme governing body of the order, which determines how the other order, it's the only group that can make permanent rules regarding how this order is governed. And I asked you to participate in this through representatives. Someone sort of said, scratched their head and said, you know, just when I stopped giving out my opinions on these things is when you start asking me for them. What is going on here? Well, what I just mentioned is what's going on. And notice, it really isn't opinions anymore, is it? Because the opinions come from the attachments, the self, the expectations, etc. When one stops trying to fix things and stops nurturing and putting forth and attempting to bring into action one's opinions, then there's room for something else. And that something else, frankly, doesn't know a lot of things. It really doesn't know. And in that not knowing, there's a sort of obviousness about things which we call wise discernment. And it is that which is being asked for when people ask, take refuge in you and ask for such things. And it is that which I asked of you and was given, you gave to me and gave to all of us at the conclave, your wise, the benefit of your wise discernment. Another thing which is useful in harmony of the Sangha is to take care with regard to teaching. And this, of course, acts, it has some different parameters, whether we're speaking of the monastic or the household sangha. But even within the monastic sangha, where we are explicitly asked to be teaching, it is something that we take care with, because unless one is explicitly asked by that particular person, or either explicitly or implicitly, but clearly asked, then one needs to be very careful. Not to inadvertently impose something on others in the name of teaching. One can learn from all, and all things and all people, and thereby respect them. When it comes to teaching, it doesn't happen usually through teaching. Funny darn business. It happens through the respect and the dropping off of opinions and all of the other things I've just been talking about and a bunch of others. And then something happens in the interaction that people call teaching. But if I get in my head and say, I'm teaching now, it screws it all up. So even more may I suggest that for you, who are not explicitly, generally, asked to give explicit teaching, but teach by being. Well, in the long run, that's what the monastics do too. There was an interesting little conference that several of us in this room went to out at my place, out at the Hermitage, the year after Reverend Master Jiyu died, and talking about discipleship and teaching and things like that. And one of the things that some of the masters out there commented, and I've forgotten who it was that commented on this or brought it up first, was saying, sort of scratching our heads and saying, you know, it seems like after a few months, or certainly after a few years, they don't remember what you said. You know, at a Dharma talk like this. But by golly, they remember how you were. Okay? And how you are as lay ministers, as I mentioned earlier, is teaching. And is very important. But if how you are is, I'm teaching you, oops, it gets in the way of the real thing, the real teaching that does occur. All right. Well, here's another one. It's fairly obvious, but I forget it. First I'm going into things that are not helpful, and then I'm going to try and shift over to some of the things I found out that are helpful. But at least for me, I have to start with finding out things that aren't helpful by sticking my foot in them time and time again. Another thing that I find that is not helpful for me in terms of harmony in the Sangha is criticizing other people. And that has many forms, both subtle and overt. Essentially, it keys into some of the other things I've already been saying. Don't do it that way, do it my way, is effectively what it's saying. And it can be said with more or less degrees of emphasis, but in any case, it's something that carries with it a judgment, not simply a discernment, but a judgment. You, fella, you're wrong, is what's behind it, okay? And sometimes, of course, it can come across very harshly. And sometimes it's sort of subtle, but there's something in there too. Okay, why not? Well, as I mentioned earlier, one of the main reasons for all of these things I've been saying that don't seem to help, for me at least, is it doesn't work. If it worked, there might be a reason, although it's unpleasant. But it really doesn't work very well. Read you a comment on this by Dogen in his Zwei Monkey, which is the record of his informal chats with his monks. This is an old version. There's a much better version out by Shohaku Okumura-san. And I don't know where this quote falls in his book, so I didn't have time to find it. So this is an old version. Dogen says, while Shakyamuni Buddha was still alive, a lot of heretics had spite against him and spoke ill of him. Now one of his disciples asked, you regard tenderness as the basis of your principle and mercy as its core. So it is natural that all living creatures should do the same to you. So why is it that there are some who do not do this? The Buddha answered, when I led a lot of disciples in my past lives, sometimes I gave to them a sharp scolding or had them perform various austere rites to admonish them for their faults. For the karma of these cruel deeds, I am now spoken ill of. Dogen continues, this episode is recorded in the Vinaya. So, in leading the followers as head novice, he was obviously speaking here to one of his head novices, you should not put them to torture with harsh words, nor expostulate with them on their faults. If you persuade them in gentle words, those who can act upon your advice will do so. I love that part. Those who can act will do so. And those who can't aren't going to be made any more likely to by the application of the 2x4. Now, there are occasional exceptions. Okay? There are occasional exceptions, particularly in a specific teacher-student relationship. But the 2x4, by definition, is a blunt instrument. Doesn't tend to have good effects. He continues, much more so is it with other Buddhist followers, i.e. the rest of us who are not the head novice or someone in a so-called disciplinary position. They should faithfully abstain from giving severe scoldings and harsh words to their fellow trainees, to acquaintances, and even to strangers. Great care should be taken with this. So if it doesn't work very well in the monastic context of master and disciple, except on very rare occasions, then it's something which is not generally going to work very well in the rest of our Sangha relationships. So first of all, it doesn't work very well. Secondly, it tends to create disharmony. It's obvious. Just think back on when you have sort of been criticized. Generally, what you hear is generally what I hear is the attack, or so it appears to me. The message gets lost. And thus, it is said that it is a thing generally not to do. And it also creates discriminative thinking in ourselves, and generally comes about from an indulgence of our own karmic patterns, which would be well to avoid. So, the sixth great precept of the Brahma's net comes into this. On speaking disparagingly of other Buddhists or gossiping about their actions that seem contrary to the precepts, I would say almost here that even those which seem contrary to the precepts, let alone those that don't. Disciples of the Buddha, should you yourself speak disparagingly or engage in gossip about the actions of any bodhisattva who is a monk or layperson of either gender, get the bodhisattva there, i.e. follower of the bodhisattva way, who is a monk or lay person of either gender, encourage someone else to do so, abet such libel or gossip, or participate in any way in such behavior, you are committing a serious offense warranting exclusion. This is a heavy one. As a bodhisattva, should you hear a wicked person who is a non-Buddhist or follower of the lesser course, speak of those who are within the Buddha Dharma, i.e. the Sangha, i.e. us, as not following the teachings or the Vinaya. You should always give rise to a compassionate heart in order to instruct and convert this wicked one and to cause the faith and virtues of the Mahayana to arise in this person. Okay, careful how you do it. But do something. If, on the contrary, as a bodhisattva, you yourself should gossip or speak disparagingly, critically, about actions amongst those within the Buddha Dharma, even, and I'm inserting the word even those which seem contrary to the precepts, you are committing a serious offense warranting exclusion. Okay. So those are some of the things that I've learned not to do. What's that leave? Where do we go? Well, as I said, one of the places we don't go is into being into a state of complete inactivity. We go instead, I think, into a life of offering. There are many offerings that can be made. One is the offering of respect. The offering of respect to all beings, and especially the offering of respect to all within the Sangha, both household and monastic. Again, Brahma's net has something to say about this. First, less grave precept. On being disrespectful, that takes it in the negative, to superiors, teachers, and friends. I'll read just the second half of this. No matter how exalted your station in life, and the first half talks about various exalted stations in life. No matter how exalted your station in life, upon seeing an abbot, a Dharma master, a precepts master, a fellow trainee, a fellow monk, a fellow Buddhist. You should stand up to welcome him and respectfully make gassho whilst making bows. If, on the contrary, as a bodhisattva, should you allow pride, arrogance, contempt, foolishness, or vanity to get hold of you, and fail to rise and welcome the arrival of such a one by respectfully bowing in gassho, and if you do not offer such a person everything as accords with the Dhamma, being completely unstinting, and he goes into lists of things one could offer, then you are defiling yourself by acting contrary to this less grave precept. Here I take rising and bowing in gassho both literally and also figuratively, especially figuratively, i.e., being respectful to not just abbots, Dharma masters, and precepts masters, but to fellow trainees, fellow monks, fellow Buddhists, i.e., the Sangha generally speaking. So, respect is something that one can make as an offering. After all, what does it cost? What harm accrues to me to respect another member of the Sangha? None. And great benefit accrues, not just to me, but to the Sangha. Respect, in this sense, we sometimes wonder if we should do it, because if we are in a state of thinking that, in the best of our ability to know, the other person is doing something that is a thing that, at least for us, is not to be done, that if we give them respect, we will somehow encourage them in breaking the precepts or whatever. Careful on that. That's a slippery slope. Number one, it's right at the edge of the door to assessing their karma and judging what's a mistake and what isn't. For them, we must discern it for us, but we mustn't judge it for them. The second thing about it is that it doesn't seem to me that giving respect under those circumstances actually, in fact, does encourage difficult, counter-perceptual things in others. It seems to be rather the opposite. Respect, the giving of respect, doesn't seem to be collusion. I mean, one can collude in non-perceptual activities, but the giving of respect isn't that. And in fact, respect seems to breed respect. And respect seems, the giving of respect seems to breed further training. So there seems to be nothing to lose and a whole lot to gain by making offerings of respect. Another offering that I've learned to make is the offering of information. And not just any old information. Information without expectations. It's what I came to call clean information. This is something I learned the hard way with Reverend Master Jiu as her chaplain. Because she would ask for information about things, and I thought I was giving her what she asked for, and she would get irked with me for it. Seemed like I was either giving her too much or too little, and I went round and round, and what is wrong here? This person's asking me for this, and as soon as I try to tell her what she's asked for, she slams me one for it. Well, after quite a while, I finally caught on to the fact that what I was giving her wasn't clean. It had strings. I wasn't even aware of them half the time. But it had strings. And that wasn't what she was asking for. She was asking for clean information. Given without expectations. No expectations is what she'd do with it. Because she'd ask me for this information, so I'd go out and find out stuff about this situation, and obviously in the process, I would come up with an idea about how it ought to be handled, right? I mean, and you can't stop yourself from doing that. But you can disconnect that. Just make the offering of clean information. set it on the altar, walk away. And that kind of information is precious. It's really, really precious. Yes, sometimes it will be misconstrued as criticism or something else. That's the other person making their karma. You make it as clean as you can, and that's the best you can do. Another offering that I found that one can make is the offering of support. Now, offering support is easy when you agree with what's going on. I'm not even going to talk about that. It's so easy. What about when you disagree with what's going on? Well, as I mentioned before, if it's the other person's call, whether it be making tea or what your committee has decided or how things are done at the temple, if it's the other person's call and real harm is not being done, harm, not somebody just feeling hurt, but real harm, counter-perceptual harm, is not being done, what I tend to do is if it's their call, I support them. Okay, I disagree, but that's okay. It's their call. They're the one that's making the tea tonight. Great, I'll help them make tea their way. Number one, it usually works out just fine. It usually works out just fine because there are often many ways of doing things that will work. And Daiswi's got his way, but it's not the only way. It seems like there are dozens of ways that will work. Even ways that seem very strange often work. And even if they don't, they often, in the process of the operation of training within those ways, they often sort of wind themselves around into a way that does. Without me getting in there and saying, no, do it this way. Okay, it's their call, I'll support them in it. And if it actually starts to fail, then I will make an offering of information, as clean as I can, about the fact of what I'm perceiving, which is, it's boiling over. Reverend, are you aware that it's boiling over? And as long as harm is not being done, for me, it is simply content. Simply context. It is the context of my training. And I will make offerings within that context. Many's the time, it actually doesn't matter which way the tea is made, which way the rule is made. It often actually doesn't matter because something greater is going on. And again, what do I have to lose by offering support in those kinds of situations? What if real harm is being done? Again, try to distinguish harm from hurt. Again, the first thing I try to do is give information. Friend, it looks like this particular harm is happening here. It looks like. I don't know in a universal eye view, but this is the way it looks to me. What think you? How does this seem? And if in your best honest perception harm is continuing to happen, what I try to do is keep giving that information. And if giving that information at one level isn't having any effect, then I start increasing the level at which that information is given. And that's why sanghas have rules, orders have rules, codes of ethics, why monks have masters, why even the masters themselves are subject to rules of an order, etc. You just take it one step at a time. And make clean offerings of information, and do not yourself participate in doing harm, because it is a thing not to be done. Again, you may be wrong, maybe no harm is being done, but you perceive it, and so you do not do it. That is different from trying to get in there and force the situation. Another thing that I've learned is that another type of offering that can be made is the offering of action. Because sometimes it's your call. Sometimes it's your turn to make the tea or write the rule. Don't be afraid to act. And to take refuge. It's a funny business, because sometimes we think that taking refuge is somehow giving over our responsibility to somebody else. Or we're afraid that if the person we're taking refuge in has a different view of the thing, that somehow we're going to have to either go with their view or go with our view, and it's all going to get mixed up. And how can I really take refuge and still do what I need to do if it's my call? Actually, they aren't. They aren't contradictory in that way. Because there's something greater going on. And in the final analysis, you have to do the best you know how. And of course, you want as much wise discernment in there as possible. And that comes from others as well as from within yourself. And if there is a significant disagreement, not dispute, but disagreement, countervailing information and countervailing discernment as to what is the wise thing to do, then what I have found is that it often means not that one is right or the other is wrong, but that there's a piece of information missing. It's what I frequently call the pussycat problem. I see a whisker. You see an ear. She sees a tail. It's a whisker. No, it's an ear. No, it's a tail. We can argue for that as long as we want to. But we really don't have adequate information here, do we? And we're all right. All of us are right. It is a whisker. It is an ear. It is a tail. And they are part of a pussycat. Or is it a skunk? Maybe I better ask for a little more information about that tail before I start patting it. Not that there's anything wrong with skunks, but you approach them a little differently than you approach pussycats. And the tail is very useful information. Now, in all of this, let me go to a special case of all of this. We've been speaking of harmony in the Sangha, some things which I find work and don't work as being helpful. Let me go into the special case of dealing with monks. Because as lay ministers, you have to deal with monks from time to time. And let me tell you, monks are a strange breed. Okay? I have learned, this is one of the things I have learned, monks are weird. On the one hand, they embody training. They embody Buddha and Dhamma. And as such, are worthy of great respect. And at the same time, they are totally human, goofy beings. And that is a strange situation. Hey, let me tell you, it's strange to be one. Monks are the most useless of beings. And I suspect that perhaps that is one of their functions, is to be totally useless in the usual sense. We don't produce anything. Therefore, our purpose is simply training itself. We have no earthly good in this world except to do training. Monks are beings who have literally given up everything in order to search for the truth. This is what the Buddha did. And for those who are called to do it, not everyone is. It is, in a sense, the highest offering of all. Now, I say that to you because I think, I hope, that by now you and I know each other well enough to know that when I say that, it is not out of disrespect for the household way of training. I say those kinds of things to you because I feel I can. Because I deeply respect and cherish the household way of training. In fact, that's one of the reasons I use the word household instead of lay. This is just me now. I'm not suggesting everyone change. Number one, it goes back as close as you can in English to the old terms that were used in the Buddha's day. And number two, having been a scientist, I know that there are other areas of the world in which the word laity is used. And it usually, it means someone who is not part of your group. Okay? Scientists speak of laymen as well. Okay? They are people who aren't scientists. Okay? And so there is the clergy and the laity being people who are not clergy. Now people, I'm not saying that the term lay is disrespectful in and of itself. It isn't. But for me, I often, for some reason, want to refer to you with a term that says something of what you are, rather than simply, you're not monks. And since the old term, as close as we can get to it in English, is householder, it's the Buddhist householder. Those who are willing and called also to give up every attachment, just as the monks are. But to do so in the midst, right in the middle of everything. To give up attachment to everything in the middle of everything. That is a high calling. And something which, in my mind, is an honorable station of life. And something worthy of the greatest respect as an integral and equal part of the Buddha's Sangha. So when I talk about, for those who are called to it, the monastic life being the highest offering, understand that it is within the context of what I just said. And it is not in the context of, well, actually, you lot are second-class monks. No. 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 And I hope by word and deed, by now, you know that from me. Because that is not how I view it. Now, in dealing with these strange beings called monks, how do you promote harmony in the Sangha in your relationship with them? Well, there are several ways of looking at this. There is one way, which is what I call the spiritual economy way. And this goes back all the way to the Buddha's time. I'm going to quote you something from the Buddha. And it is a basis for the respect and mutual respect of monks and householders. However, and I could be wrong here, I could be blaspheming the Buddha, I don't think it's the highest understanding of our relationship between monastics and householders. Nonetheless, it's a valid one. And it's one that is frequently used, so let me put it forth here. In five ways should the householder minister to monks as at the zenith of the... He's talking about how you relate to people of all sorts, okay? And he's talking about those in the Western Quarter and those in the Eastern Quarter and the Northern and the South and then, and you know, down below and up above. Okay, so he's talking about this is the last one, as those in the up above. By affection in act and speech and mind. by keeping open house to them, by supplying their temporal needs. Thus ministered to, should monks show their love for the householder in six ways: restrain him from evil, exhort him to good, love him with kindly thoughts, teach him what he has not heard, correct and purify what he has heard, and reveal the way. That's lovely. That's really, really lovely. And it is based, as you can see in here, on love and affection in both directions. And even that, I think, doesn't go far enough. Because I think there is a basis for a mutual respect and love between us simply for being who we are. I felt some of that yesterday as celebrant for that ceremony. I don't know how you felt about that ceremony, but I really liked that ceremony. Something happened at that ceremony, and you're the ones that asked for that ceremony. Something happened, and there was an aspect of Sangha that happened, and it was based, so I could feel, of mutual love and respect. And I didn't get a sense of a spiritual economy here. I got a sense of something bigger than that. That we give, all of us, to one another simply out of respect and love for being who we are. So in that respect, maybe that is a basis for relating to monastics. Respect them and love them just for being what they are. Now, of course, that's easy to say. And it's a little harder to do when things get problematic. One of the things that makes things problematic sometimes is that monks have very funny attitudes about things. And this used to drive me nuts, so I imagine it drives you nuts sometimes as well. When I first came to the monastery, and even after being a monk for a number of years, it really irked me how inefficient this place was. But you know what? Monks don't put a very high value on efficiency. And they don't put a very high value on productivity either. In fact, one of the other interesting little comments that was made at this conference or get-together of teachers was, someone said, well, you know, you can't quite take the old Machiavellian dictum that the ends justifies the means and turn it on its head and say the means justifies the ends, but darn it, it's close. In other words, they were saying how we do things for the monastic, how you do things is so important that it's at least as important, and maybe it's actually more important than what you get done. And that is a weird thing. So understand that you're dealing, in many cases, with people who have a very funny attitude towards getting things done. The task, in other words, is just another context. It's a context for training, and it's a context for Sangha, and it's a context for the outflowing of Dhamma. And if widgets get made, great, but the widget making for monks isn't all that important. So it's sometimes helpful to simply know that little piece of information. It's also useful to keep in mind the other side of the whole business, that is the goofy human being side. Now again, that's easy to hear, but it's not so easy when you have to live with one of these goofy people day in and day out. And believe me, I've had to do that for the last 26 whatever years. I live with these people. Goodness gracious. Um, And when we are goofy, and believe me, we get goofy, logically, one would be tempted to conclude, well, they wouldn't be that way if they were really enlightened. If they were really training, they wouldn't act that way. Now, I hope you've seen a number of the problems with that, in what I've talked about beforehand. This is a special case of the general case that I presented earlier. And when I start thinking that way, one of the things I ask myself is, oh, and who is training for, pray tell? Is training for the saintly, or is training for the goofy? And we are here as trainees, we monks. Therefore, I suspect we are among the goofy. And training is going on, and training is continuing. And what do I expect? And then, of course, that leads me into, ooh, I seem to be judging some things here, and I might be, yes, stuff I talked about earlier. And then it's also useful in this context to remember some of the things that Dogen said. A couple little lines, and Reverend Master Jiyu quotes this in Zen's Eternal Life as well. This is from the Raihai Tokozui of Reverend Hubert's translation. Shakyamuni Buddha said, "Should you meet teachers who expound supreme enlightenment, do not inquire into their family pedigree, do not look at their personal appearance, do not despise their shortcomings, do not be concerned with their behavior. Simply out of respect and esteem for spiritual wisdom, feed such persons daily and give them celestial flowers, ounces of gold, etc." In other words, make offerings to these people. "And reverently bow and pay your respects without letting feelings of resentment arise in you." Okay. Now, note particularly in this, the little sort of, it's almost sort of parenthetical, what you don't look at. Don't look at their pedigree. Okay, fair enough, we know not to look at that. Right, right. Their personal appearance, yeah, we know not to judge a book by its cover. Their shortcomings, oops, they've got them. Don't despise their shortcomings. These are teachers who expound supreme enlightenment. Don't despise their shortcomings or be concerned with their behavior. Oops, they've got it? Yeah. They're goofy people. They've got it. They're all going to have shortcomings and behaviors that you don't particularly like. And you don't have to copy them. Okay? Back to that again. If it is something which, in your best discernment, is a thing not to be done, then do not do it. Even if Monk X is doing it, do not do it. If in your conscience it is a thing for you not to do. But if Dogen expects, and Shakyamuni Buddha expected, that even those who expound supreme enlightenment as teachers will have shortcomings and somewhat funny behaviors, then probably they're going to. So you probably shouldn't expect it to be different from that. And if you do expect it to be different, it's going to get rough, because it's not the way it is. And sometimes, out of their compassion, if a monk sees you doing that and expecting them to be perfect and putting them up on a pedestal to be dusted, the monk will do outrageous things. I can remember Reverend Master Jiyu from time to time turning up in a muumuu. All right, gang. What is it you're paying respect to or being disrespectful to? Is it the robe? Or is it the being? Can you respect your teacher in a muumuu? Or is it something you put the robe up on a pedestal and you're sort of putting it up there dusting? Fair enough, all well and good, but suppose that I, as a trainee, monastic or householder, don't seem to benefit from the teaching of a given monk at the moment. And you may not. At least you may not see any way of which you are benefiting at the moment. No one says that you have to perceive benefit from the teaching of every monk at every moment. That is not a reason to disrespect them or fail to support them or all the other things we talked about in the general case. But there is no expectation that every person is going to easily learn from the teaching of every monastic at all times. There are differences between teachers. And it's good that there are, because there are differences between us as students. And sometimes things will mesh, and sometimes things will sort of go clunk. And that's all right. One of the other interesting things we as teachers were exploring with ourselves is, wow, we're really different. And yet, something is the same. Something underneath comes through, but we're very different in the way we come through with things. And we're very different in the way we teach, not as methodology, because we don't have methodology, just the way it comes out. Some teachers are very personal in how they teach. Others are very impersonal. Some are very directive. They will tell you what to do. Others are very indirective. You ask them a question and you don't get an answer. You get another question. Now, for some people, that's great. And for other people, that's maddening. But that's the way they are. Some teachers are formal and teach through the form. Others are very informal. And of course, there are gradations on all these dimensions. Okay, it's not just all on one side, or you aren't just all on one side or all on the other. These are continua. Some of us are generalists in the Dhamma, and some of us are sort of specialists. And we can't help ourselves, we just somehow specialize in certain things. Or conversely, we just can't specialize. We have to be generalists. Some of us are very verbal. You're looking at one. For better or worse, you're looking at a wordsmith. And you know what? When this wordsmith wants to go for sanzen, for refuge, he doesn't go to another wordsmith. This wordsmith goes to those who teach with the rolling pin and the pipe wrench. And there are those who preach profound sermons with a pipe wrench or a rolling pin or a ceremonial hoss without speaking a word. And so it is. And maybe you can learn easily from the one with the rolling pin and not the one with the ceremonial hoss, or from the one with the ceremonial hoss and not the one with the words, or from either and not the one with the pipe wrench, or vice versa. Okay, learn from where you can learn. And that is not a reason to disrespect the ones from which you don't learn. And if you make a commitment to a particular teacher, as some of you do, and some of you don't, and that's fine both directions, we'll be talking about that when we talk about lay discipleship. If you make a particular commitment to a particular monastic as a teacher, then when they are goofy, understand that that is going to happen. Again, do not do yourself what is not to be done. And also, do not give up too quickly on this teaching relationship that you have asked for. Do not be too quick to say, maybe not, when things get rough, because things are going to get rough from time to time. It is the nature of teaching relationships that they bring up rough spots, and they do so on both sides. Do not be quick to abandon such a relationship if you establish it. Finally, getting back to the general, one thing that helps me a lot is one of the laws of the universe, which, as Reverend Master Jiu put it, without fail, the wheel of the law is always turning. In the long run, in other words, training will have its effects, is how I put it. It has its effects upon all of us in the Sangha, and they are profound. It therefore helps me to take a long-term, big-picture view, and I offer that to you as well. I am less likely to make mistakes in harmony in the Sangha if I keep a long-term, big-picture view. And as I was saying, or as one of the other monks and I were sort of musing about training during the most recent monk session here, towards the end of it, you sort of get into that kind of conversation once in a while. And she and I were talking about how we were continuously impressed by our inability to make training happen. And to fix ourselves. It just gets deeper and deeper how much one has to let go of knowing and how deeply into unknowing one has to go. And one of us looked at the other and said, you know what? Not only seems like you can't make training happen, but you can't even stop it from happening, except temporarily. Except temporarily. Even the mistakes within a context of honest training, even the mistakes get used. And that is very comforting. And that helps me to take a long-term, big-picture view and helps me, therefore, to see the value and act in accord with harmony in the Sangha. And so these are things I offer to you as well. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.